Hello, everyone, and welcome to a very special I Heart This. Today, I'm delighted to talk to poet and artist Bianca Stone. Stone is the author of a number of poetry collections, including Someone Else's Wedding Vows, The Mobius Strip Club of Grief, and What is Otherwise Infinite, which won the Vermont Book Award in 2022. She is also a poet-comic artist who uses illustration to illuminate her own poetry and the poetry of others. Stone is the editor-at-large of Iterant, a quarterly poetry magazine, the co-founder of the Ruth Stone House, a poetry-based nonprofit, the host of her own podcast on poetry and consciousness called Ode and Psyche, and is currently serving as Vermont's Poet Laureate. All right, Bianca Stone, welcome to I Heart This.
Hi.
Superman is from Krypton and Spider-Man was bitten by a radioactive spider. So what's your poetry origin story?
It's a pretty good one. I grew up with a grandmother who was a poet, Ruth Stone, and my grandfather, Walter Stone, was also a poet. He died before I was born, but there was an atmosphere of art and writing being the most important vocation one could ever hope to stumble into, and I watched it with some awe and excitement. I mean, it's not every child of a writer who feels that way necessarily, and I think that was a lot of the spirit of my grandmother, who just had such a easeful way of engaging with poetry and just lived and breathed it. It wasn't something that existed only in a professional academic realm that wasn't part of the home. And because I think my family was very disorganized and, you know, I had a single mother and everything was unpredictable, there was this sense of poetry being an outlet, a constant, a way to express oneself that was like, even from a really young age, I recognized that that gift. Yeah, my origin story for poetry is like hearing it very early on, seeing how a poet lived, and knowing that that was what I was going to do.
Do you feel like you absorbed some important lessons about craft or about the life of an artist from your grandmother?
Yeah, I saw her process just by being in proximity to her, which was a lot of reading and a lot of writing on whatever was around her. You're kind of always engaging with the act of writing. So whether that's writing on the back of a receipt or on the back of a checkbook or, you know, in the front pages of a book, I'll open, you know, Best American Poetry 1987, and there's a poem written on the inside cover of it because she just got inspired and started writing. So one thing I learned from her was to constantly be on the lookout for poetry and to follow it whenever it strikes. And of course, to read, to research and record and process everything, not just poetry books, but, you know, fiction and nonfiction, children's books, you know, all of it.
And now, congratulations, you are the Vermont Poet Laureate. What's that been like?
It's been good. I mean, I actually haven't been officially inducted yet. I haven't actually made it to the State House yet, which is funny. It's funny at all that I get to go to the State House and have this like relationship to the political system as a poet. Being a poet laureate of anything is an honorary position. So you get to sort of be validated in the fact that you're on the right path in terms of your writing practice and your engagement with poetry and with the poetry community. And so I continue to just do that. I'm writing. I just finished my new book and teach constantly. I'm constantly working on projects. In terms of Vermont Poet Laureate things, I'll say some words at Writers in Recovery. They're having their 10-year anniversary, or I'll do an introduction to an anthology of city poems in Montpelier. They hang poems up on the windows of storefronts. I get to speak on behalf of poetry in the small communities of Vermont, or like speaking at the local library about poetry or something like that. I think one has to be careful not to be like an unpaid civil servant when it's like doing too much. And I always feel this like pressure to have to like make everyone fall in love with poetry or something. And so I try to do it usefully and yes, have fun with it, right? And I think the most important thing to remember in a position like this is working on my poetry is as important as trying to convince a room of people that poetry is worth listening to. And it's also challenging because I have to think about ways to talk about poetry to different kinds of people, right? So if I'm going to my daughter's school and it's K-8, I gotta think about what that means to talk about poetry to that group of people. And or am I talking to people at the local library and they've been writing, they know something about poetry, things like that.
What you were saying about trying to convince a room full of people about the worthwhileness of poetry kind of strikes me. And it just feels sometimes like it's really nerdy and niche. I read a couple of interviews that you'd given to other folks before. And in one of them, you were talking about how poetry demands more of the reader. And that's probably one of the reasons why it's not as widely read as, mystery novels. Do you think poetry needs evangelists? Do you think that it's okay if it's just this nerdy niche thing? Do you think it demands a bigger role in public life?
Okay, when we talk about poetry being demanding for the reader, some poetry is. People say to me, poetry is so hard, I don't understand poetry. And some of those people who are saying that to me are reading some of the most difficult philosophical and scientific criticism that anyone could hope to read. And I thought to myself, here, this is not about education in a way. This is not about, oh, you have to be like trained in poetry to understand poetry. We don't have a culture that has any sort of educational system that engages with poetry anymore. That used to be the way in, let's like Greek culture, for example, or like ancient Asian cultures. Like, poetry was ubiquitous and pervasive throughout their educational system and their culture and their society. So that kind of question was never posed, right? So why is it posed in ours, right? We don't have an understanding of the complexity and the multifarious nature of poetry. So to come back to my friends who are, reading Lacan and then they're saying, I don't understand poetry. It's interesting because there's an element of poetry that demands you let go of trying to understand it. So you kind of have to just surrender. Now, at the same time, there's this other thing that happens when you let go of that anxiety of having to understand everything. And so you find this poem and it just sort of happens to you, right? So even without understanding everything in the poem, you sense these truths about it are happening to you. You sense an emotional event. So I think it's important to remember that it's not your fault that you don't know how to read poetry. A lot of enjoyment and love of poetry comes from finding the poetry that you love and enjoy, right? Because there's lots of different kinds of poetry that does lots of different kinds of things. And that's really the fun of it. This is what people discover when they fall in love with poetry, is that they get to hunt for the poems they love and the poems that speak to them. Because I read poetry all the time, every day, and I have for most of my life. And a lot of poetry I don't actually like and doesn't speak to me
It makes me think a
is.
couple things. Like, one is, like, I never felt like I needed to understand nursery rhymes. They're nonsense, most of them, right? But, like, it's okay. Nobody is like, oh man, I just don't understand that whole Jack and Jill thing. Like, why did he break his crown? Like, nobody asks that about that kind of thing. And nobody kind of has this like blanket statement really in everyday life where they're like, well, I don't like TV, right? Like people like their shows and they know that they're not going to like every show. And they go around and they hunt for
programming that they like. He makes me wonder, like, why is poetry different than that? Why do we expect that we have to like it as, like,
All of it, right. And the other thing about it is that some poems are really simple, right? And there's also a deceptiveness in simplicity, right? So some poems will seem really obvious and simple, and they're the most complex truths to come to the more you read them. And I also think of myth here because, you know, when you think of the old epics like the Odyssey and the Iliad, which were oral poems and then eventually written down, and those are narratives, they're stories. They're actually pretty easy to understand narratively, which a lot of poems that you read are narrative poems, right? They're like a little story, they're a little anecdote, they're a little snippet of experience. When we talk about more accessible poetry, we're often talking about that kind of poetry, right? The thing about those poems is that they continue to offer different angles of understanding, and there's always going to be something in those myths and those poems that we keep coming back to. Now, that's why we keep getting stuff out of, you know, Shakespeare plays and things like that. That's why we keep translating the Iliad, you know, and people keep finding relevance in the Odyssey. There's these human truths in there that keep offering up information to us about how to live and what it means to be in this world. Now, there's something about, quote, difficulty and hiddenness in poetry that is crucial to it being poetry, right? Because now this is why poetry is so incredible, and this is probably why people fear it, and also it's been squeezed out of our society, because there's these inherent enduring truths about how to live that there's something about them that demand work on your part in terms of your consciousness and your participation that is required to understand the hidden truths in those poems. So yes, poetry demands something of the reader, but that's a gift, right? It's not happening to you. It's not telling you what is. It's telling you there are these truths that you have to participate in to discover. And so there's this phenomenon when people find a poem they love where they think, this poem is speaking right to me. Mm. You know, and this is the Bible as well, because a lot of that is verse as well. You feel seen by these moments in poetry because of this phenomenon of it having this very individualized singing that is also universal. So it's this incredible overlap of ordinary individual life and a vast enduring consciousness that speaks to what it is to be human. If we talk about it like that, right, we're talking about something pretty different than, like, oh, the elitist poets writing their weird pastime Nietzsche thing in their institutions. This is a genre with roots in the unfathomable past. So if we're talking about poetry and its history, we're talking about the history of humanity. You know, it breaks my heart when people say poetry is irrelevant. People don't read poetry. Poetry's dead. I think, well, then humanity's dead. But I'll say this other thing. The amount of people reading poetry, right? It's not on the New York Times bestseller list. It's not the most read genre. Like, people don't make money off of poetry. That's poetry, right? I wish we had a society that supported artists and gave them money to just do their art and saw that as valuable. But poets will do it nonetheless, right? They don't do it to get paid. They don't do it because it's a quote unquote job that makes money. They do it because they're drawn to do it by something much more involved with vocation, passion, being human, being interested in what it means to be in this world and to communicate with one another. Poets often have this anxiety about getting people to like poetry more. And in some ways, like, poetry is a little bit marginalized because of its hard truths, its complexity. It's like things that people don't want to look at. It's always going to be a little bit of a niche thing, right? And that's okay. It's something that will continue to come back to the individual experience, and that's just more private. It's more difficult to market.
Yeah, there's actually something kind of beautiful about the fact that you don't make a living writing poetry, and people keep doing it just because it's awesome. There's another thing that you said about how there are these moments when you find some poem somewhere that feels like it is speaking directly to you. Are there particular poems where you had that experience where you felt like, wow, this one is written right to me?
Definitely. I think the most recent for me include Rilke's elegies, his Duino elegies, and especially the first elegy, "Who, if I cried out, would hear me among the angelic orders?" There's this moment of coming to a real despair and a feeling of helplessness. Rilke, when this first line of this series of elegies came to him, was coming out of a great depression personally and wasn't writing. And this wind came up off the sea and hit him. And he heard, so legend say, on the wind, this line, you know, who if I cried out would hear me among the angelic orders or the angelic hierarchies. And it goes from there. This feeling of the human calling out and saying, who is there and who will hear me? Will it be other humans? Will it be the lover? Will it be God? Will it be angels? Will it be animals? What is my place in this world? I remember distinctly a moment of great despair I was feeling, and I just opened that up, and it felt like he was articulating everything I was feeling, but I couldn't put words to. And there's an enormous, I wouldn't even say the word comfort, I would say solidarity in those moments. There's also a similar poem by Goethe, another German speaking writer, translated by Robert Bly, called The Holy Longing, which I can read if you want.
That would be lovely.
So it speaks too, I think, to what we've been saying. It's called The Holy Longing. Tell a wise person, or else keep silent, because the mass man will mock it right away. I praise what is truly alive, what longs to be burned to death. In the calm waters of the love nights, where you were begotten, where you have begotten, a strange feeling comes over you when you see the silent candle burning. Now you are no longer caught in the obsession with darkness, and a desire for higher lovemaking sweeps you upward. Distance does not make you falter. Now, arriving in magic, flying, and finally insane for the light, you are the butterfly, and you are gone. And so long as you haven't experienced this, to die, and so to grow, you are only a troubled guest on this dark earth. So that's such a perfect example. This idea comes up in a lot of other poems and in a lot of spiritual texts too, this idea of rebirth and the hero's journey and things that require a certain kind of person to hear it and require you as a certain kind of person to hear it. So that idea of tell a wise person or else keep silent because the mass man will mock it right away. I think he's talking about mass society, right? Like the average statistical person who's not really an individual, really is just like a sea of people, will mock it.
Can I ask you a little bit about your own poetry?
Yes.
So you just read, we're talking about Rilke, and Rilke wrote a series of elegies. Many of the poems that I've read of yours, you've called elegies. So what's an elegy and why that form?
Yeah, it's really fun to talk about elegies because it's a very powerful form. Traditionally, or I'd say even more contemporary idea of the elegy is that it's a poem in lament for somebody who's died. So it's involved with singing of the lost beloved, which so much poetry is. Poetry was probably first born out of that need to sing of the lost love. Where do they go, right? But the elegy form has had other definitions throughout time, and Rilke engages with those too. for somebody like Dante, it was more of a love poem actually. And then also it was involved with a certain meter. So it's not just about one who's died, but also just like a form. So the elegy as a form has always been of interest to me. I think my second book, which was all elegies pretty much, and was dedicated to my grandmother Ruth, written a lot of these poems written after she died, but they were also elegies for the living. The sort of double layer of all of that was that my grandmother, whose poetry I grew up listening to and was just sort of like built into my psyche and my identity as a poet, always was writing elegies for her dead husband. This almost idealizing of the dead that I grew up around, right? And the constant mourning of the lost love in such a violent way, and all the poems that I was hearing about him. And not just him, you know, her other people she wrote about too, her family, was just, it was strange to have the elegy, know her elegies, and then to be mourning her death, right? And to be learning about what it means to mourn and experience that first great loss in your life. So it's a very important moment for a poet to really see the depth of what elegy is and its necessity in our world. Because grief is the hardest thing to deal with, and poetry, that's when poetry steps in.
Word. I read somewhere that you'd said, we write poetry to remember, but also we write poetry to remember to forget.
That's so psychoanalytic of me to say.
You strike me as a Carl Jung fan.
I am.
Is that
Definitely.
true? Okay, awesome. Are there moments that you keep trying to remember? Or remembering to forget? Like, are there the things that you keep coming back to over and over again in
Oh,
your work?
definitely. Yeah. So I just finished Haha, my new book. Just sent it to my publisher final round, and I'm looking through it and I'm thinking, Jesus, like, not only do I revisit things from previous books, sometimes directly, I'm like, oh, two-thirds of the way through my last book, I also had a poem that was an ekphrastic that mentioned unicorns in it. You know, like I've done the exact same thing again. People joke about it all the time, poets repeating themselves and writing the same poem over and over again. It's like, you know, sometimes it's a problem, sometimes it's a gift. It's like you're trying to figure something out. And like oftentimes there's something that you can't articulate that the poem can only grasp towards. And one is trying to get the right words in the right order to nail it and then move on. I mean, it's like that in psychoanalysis too. And that's why I think I'm drawn now to and being fascinated by psychoanalysis, because it too is interested in memory and image and inner and outer worlds and bringing them together and articulating in a certain way to be able to come to some sort of like understanding of something and move past it, right? So,
Can
of
I?
course, I disagree with everything right after I say it, but yeah, I that's okay. It's the paradox of it
Yeah,
all
right.
is, yeah.
Well, and can I jump in as you're talking? It makes me realize that I, as a reader of poetry, come back to the same poets again and again,
Yeah.
maybe because they are wrestling with the same moments that they're trying to remember or remember to forget. Like, I think one of the reasons that I love Walt Whitman, and he very much does exactly what you're talking about. Like, in so many of his poems, he is trying to approach the same thing. And it's okay that so many of his poems echo each other because I'm looking for that same thing that maybe he's looking for.
Exactly. I think there's a comfort in the continuity and the echoing. There is an arc to understanding of something, and it will keep repeating, right? It's a refrain, but it's also a conversation, right? So the conversation with oneself. This is the conversation of poetry, too. Poets are in conversation with other poets too. And those poets are in conversations with philosophers, and they're in the social conversations. What I'm saying is, like, that happens interiorly too. It's almost like you have this you have this interior world that you are wrestling with your entire life. This is why it's so fun to be a poet, because it's your inner journey of remembrance and understanding of what happened in your life and what is happening in your life out in the outer real world, and then what's also happening on the inner world as you go. And, like, so of course it would keep coming back in other poems. Of course it would echo things more and again and again, and even across books or within the same book. In my books, my grandma's part of that conversation, especially in the Mobius Strip Club of Grief, which the title itself was riffing off of her poem, The Mobius Strip of Grief, which the whole thing is very meta, because a Mobius strip is a strip that is a kind of like an infinity symbol, right? It just, like, goes on and on, never.
Right. It's a three-dimensional shape with just one side, right?
One side, but two sides.
Yeah, right.
So it's also a symbol of the dyad, right? So it's like, again, that conversation and that echoing is like, is one side, but it has two sides, right? So it's like, it's a great, the great paradoxes of math and poetry. Yeah, so my new book is so echoey, and the poems are constantly wrestling, and, like, some lines will continue to come back verbatim throughout the book. And so I took it really far in this book. Now, this book is way less in conversation with Ruth or anything. It's more with like Carl Jung or something. Yeah, and myself. Yep.
Would you be interested in reading one of your poems for us?
This poem always seems appropriate. It's like a newer poem.
Is this from your new book?
Yeah, it is in my new book. It's already been published in a magazine, so it's okay. It's called What's Poetry Like? Poets play the winter tarantella, making love in the midnight hours on a white iron bed like a dog skeleton, distinguishing the essential and unessential moment shared between ordinary lunatics and screaming over a bird in an apple tree until an elegy has to be written to resuscitate the relation. Those who look toward the depleted wildlife of neighborhoods with tragic relish to see somehow ourselves disappearing about ourselves. Once in New York City years ago, the internet technician finally arrived. His teenage apprentice stood in my living room over a Trans-Tromer book. He said it looked kind of cool, and he wanted to know what it was. Poetry, I said. What's poetry like, he asked. And the treacherous inadequacy with which one finds oneself explaining in a few loose, deficient words something with lungs and no face, the immortal freak of language you haunt and hunt, which is the original state of language you're trying to get back to from within. Poetry, whose rare geniuses come as bittersweet, suicidal explosions on the tongue, randomly felt during long, tedious meals, award-winning and already forgotten. All the emoting of the unanalyzable fragments, all the surrender and detonations of precision and reckless insight and reference to hidden wisdom and Coke cans, conversations across time, and slips into truth and obscurity of thought altogether blissfully, the form itself at its best, strings of dreams in the waking life, overlaid like unobserved clothing, the words that sing stillness, the silence craved by perpetual auctioneers, that which is not the tale of event, but itself an event. You know what? Just take the book, I said finally, pushing it into his hands. Thanks, he said, and took it away, grinning a little. But later, with snow in my head and the thunder in my right eyelid, I was worried, as I was so dangerously then, about dark yet unspoken things that frightened me. That shiny black and white book, wafting around New York City in the back of a Time Warner cable van, waiting to be opened, waiting to torment him, thinking of it changing his life.
strings of dreams in a waking life. Well, I can't think of a more perfect way to end this conversation. Bianca, that was awesome. Thank you so much for taking time to talk with me, and for sharing your thoughts about poetry. And Vermont's a small state, and there's a small portion of us who are really interested in poetry, so I'm sure I'll bump into you again sometime soon.
I know we will, and I appreciate it so much, Ben, for your thoughtful questions.
I highly recommend checking out more of Bianca's work. You'll find links to her podcast, to the Ruth Stone House, and to a bunch of her books in our show notes. I Heart This has new episodes every Wednesday. It is written, edited, and produced by me, Ben Lord. Our logo was designed by Bryony Morrow Cribbs. Our theme song is used with permission from neosounds.com. Our website is iheartthispodcast.com. We're on Facebook at I Heart This Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. And as always, be kind, be curious, and be thankful.